Concordia University Chicago is the distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're committed to increasing LCMS faculty and staff members. This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago. If you are a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod with excellent professional credentials, please consider applying for our faculty or staff family. Current openings are posted at cuchicago.edu/HR.
The headline in the Washington Post magazine asks the question, is this biblical food the next foodie fad? This chef thinks so. It's a story about the Mediterranean-inspired restaurant at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. One of the twists that they're putting into their culinary offerings is what they call manna. It's a resin that is imported. They import it from the Middle East. It's apparently kind of sweet in flavor, melts in your mouth, and they sprinkle it on all manner of culinary offerings there. They're calling it manna. They're saying you can eat manna just like the children of Israel ate manna in the wilderness. Where did this idea that manna exists today come from? And is this manna that you can actually order right off the menu in Washington, D.C. at the Museum of the Bible? Joining us to talk about this Washington Post story about manna as a possible food fad, Dr. Andrew Steinman, Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University Chicago. He's author of the Concordia Commentaries on 1 and 2 Samuel, Proverbs, Daniel, and Ezra and Nehemiah. Dr. Steinman, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Good to be here with you, Todd.
In the story of the New York Times, they're talking about a foodie fad where they are making fish kebabs, and they're putting on the kebabs and other foods a resin that they import from the Middle East. It's apparently flavorful, and they're calling it manna. Is that the biblical manna?
Very unlikely, Todd. The only thing it has in common is that it's from the same general area of the world.
So it does tie into one of the theories that largely liberal Bible scholars have been putting forward about where the biblical manna actually came from. What is that theory?
The theory is that it's some plant resin that the Israelites found in the desert and that they ate. But of course, these liberal Bible scholars are discounting many of the facts of the text itself. For instance, the text says it was all around the ground on the camp of the Israelites, and that's not possible with this resin. It would be maybe dripping off of plants and congealing on the ground near the plants, but it obviously wouldn't be all around the camp. And then the manna followed them for 40 years. That's not likely to have happened with some natural occurring substance like that. And the manna even follows them into the promised land until they eat the first produce of the land. The book of Joshua tells us when the manna stopped. And so it's not just in the desert, in the Sinai somewhere where they had manna, but they had manna the whole way up around the Dead Sea and over the Jordan into the promised land. The Bible really is depicting this as a supernatural phenomenon, something that God provided in a way that's out of the ordinary. And these liberal Bible scholars, of course, discount the idea of any supernatural intervention in the world. And so they try to come up with some naturalistic explanation for it. And so that's why they oftentimes say, well, it was some plant resin that they found on the ground. And that's what they were eating.
It could, I mean, I guess not only discount those features of the text that you were talking about, but the biblical account depicts the giving of manna as a daily thing that actually stopped one day a week, and yeah, that they were able to gather not only a daily amount to feed entire families, but a double amount on the day before the Sabbath.
Yeah, I mean, it's these type of descriptions that defy any logic of saying this is a naturally occurring substance. And the whole problem with trying to identify it then is you have to make identification on the pared down facts. You have to pare out facts from the text, and you get down to well, it tasted like wafers made with honey, and so we'll try to find some naturally occurring substance, in this case, this resin, that we think reasonably fits that description. And that's about the only thing they're taking out of the text other than a general Near Eastern location.
So we could safely say they're not serving manna at the bistro at the Bible Museum in Washington, D.C. Let's talk about the real thing, that which not only was given to the people for their 40 years of exile, so to speak, in the wilderness before entering the promised land, but it then was later preserved inside the Ark of the Covenant for a time. Let's talk about the story of the manna and how God initially gave it to them. Why did he give them manna?
Well, they were grumbling in the desert that they missed the food they had back in Egypt. They were blaming God for bringing them out into the desert where they would die. And of course, Moses too felt this. They were angry at Moses. And so God gave them two things to eat. We have the account of him giving them this manna, which would follow them throughout their 40 years in the wilderness. And he also gave them quail to eat too. So many of the Israelites were able to subsist on this for 40 years. And the people of Israel had this as their main diet, apparently. They often referred to it as almost like bread because, of course, in the ancient world, even today to some extent, bread is known as the staff of life. And many ancient societies, bread was the basic food. And so manna sometimes is referred to as bread, especially when you come to the New Testament and connecting it with the miracle of the fish and the loaves where Jesus supplies bread. And there's some reference to manna there. So this was a very important provision of God for the people. And it really points to God's patience with the Israelites and his grace toward them despite their sins, because they're grumbling against God, and yet he still provides for them. They're not grateful for him bringing them out of bondage in Egypt, and yet he still provides for them. And it reminds us of how patient and merciful God can be with people and is, and that his main quality is his mercy and grace. And that's highlighted by this story.
Why is it given the way it's given, and that is on a strictly daily basis with the exception of the day before the Sabbath? Why does God provision them with manna and the quail in this particular way?
He does it this way as a constant reminder that they are dependent on him for their provisions, that it's God who provides them and indeed us with all that we have. And oftentimes, it's easy to think of our food as coming from, you know, our work, the kind of the produce that we have earned by our various vocations. But God is reminding them that, and us, that we get this daily bread from him. And that's, of course, picked up again in the Lord's Prayer when Jesus teaches us to pray for our daily bread, for what we need for the day, so that we trust that what we have day by day is from God, rather than thinking of it only as something we earn by our own works.
Is there also, and I think this is in the original text there too, that I might test them, God tells Moses. Is there a testing quality to that provision as well?
Well, yeah, and we see that early on when he instructs them not to take more than they can eat in a day. And when they do take more than they can eat in a day, it spoils. And so God is testing them to whether they will follow his instructions and lean on his provision, or whether they will try to lean on their own understandings and their own way of providing for themselves. And so very early on in the story of them giving of the manna, we find out about this spoilage that happens because they don't follow directions.
Dr. Steinman, it's also referred to as angel's bread or the bread of angels. He fed them with the bread of angels. What should we make of that particular reference to the daily provision of manna?
Yeah, I don't think that's a reference to the angels eating manna. I think it's probably a reference to the angels as God's agent in providing the manna. And the Bible talking about this as the bread of angels is mainly talking about God using these creatures that he created, these supernatural creatures we call angels, as his servants to provide these things for the people of Israel.
The ingratitude of the people seems to be perpetual. At some point, they even begin to grumble about the manna that God had been feeding them absolutely free. We should note that none of them had to work to get this at all. In fact, part of the whole goal was for them not to work to receive this bread and this meat that came in the form of quail. But eventually, they even grumble about the food itself, don't they?
Yes, and this is why God gets pretty impatient with them at one point, because he's been so gracious to them, and he's taken care of them. He's shown them all these miracles in Egypt, some of those plagues of Egypt, they were spared from having to experience, and they saw his power in Egypt. And yet, despite that, they have a hard time just simply trusting in the God who did all that for them. And so I guess it just talks about the sinful nature that dwells within all of us, that in some sense, we all have trouble accepting God's gracious gifts. And this story of them grumbling against God calls us to repentance too, when we realize that we're not often as grateful as we should be for the provisions God gives to us every day.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're talking about a Washington Post story about a food fad. They're calling it manna. It isn't, but it occasions a conversation on manna in the Bible. It'll continue with the other kind of provisions that God made for the children of Israel during their exile in the wilderness. Stay tuned.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans in their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
Your daily Lutheran Bible class. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Dr. Daniel Gard, president of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children. Concordia University Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and we are committed to our Lutheran confession and heritage. Please encourage the student in your life to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the language of medicine and law today. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR17. Memoria Press, a classical Christian education that works.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues, Etc. 300. St. John Lutheran, Springfield, Pennsylvania. Zion Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan. St. Paul's Lutheran, Long Beach, California. All Saints Lutheran, Charlotte, North Carolina.
Redeemer Lutheran, Colorado Springs, Colorado, Shepherd of the Lake Lutheran, Garrison, Minnesota, Emmanuel Lutheran, Kansas City, Missouri, and Holy Cross Lutheran, St. Genevieve, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues, etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues, etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues, etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues, etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Thursday, August the 9th. We're talking about manna in the Bible. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest, Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. Dr. Steinman, there are more means of provision that God laid out before his people during their exile in the wilderness. One of them we hear about at the very end of that wandering, and that is that their clothes and their shoes did not suffer anywhere for all of those 40 years that they spent in the wilderness. Talk about this one.
Yeah, so there's no mention anywhere of them having to figure out where they're going to get new clothes or making new shoes, sandals to wear throughout their journeys. And God, apparently, according to the words of Moses, God kept all these things from wearing out. Now, you might think you have a good pair of shoes nowadays, and they seem like, you know, you can wear them forever and they're like iron, but even those are going to wear out over 40 years. We might have clothes that we've had for a number of years, and you know, they're kind of fond possessions we have, and we like to have that particular shirt or that particular pair of pants, and they seem to last for a long time. But nobody wears anything for 40 years, day in and day out, and not experience some wear. And the fact that Moses can refer to this as the Israelites didn't have to concern themselves with these basic necessities of life shows how very careful God was in providing for his people and things that when they got into the promised land, they were going to have to take care of themselves. And so for these 40 years, even though it was a time of punishment for the generation that rebelled and refused to go into the land, it was still also a time of God's grace when he graciously provided for things that at some point I'm sure they just took for granted.
Should we take seriously the contention made by the Apostle Paul that in addition to the food and the meat and the clothes that did not wear out, that this miraculous flow of water from a rock followed them through the wilderness?
Yes, because it's mentioned several times in different contexts that God brings them water from the rock. And so very early on, God provides them water from the rock. And then near the very end of their wanderings, Moses, of course, because of his disobedience in an incident with bringing water from the rock at near the end of this 40 years, is not going to be able to go into the promised land. So Paul isn't pointing to a particular Bible passage that says the rock followed them around, but he is pointing to the cumulative evidence from the Pentateuch that the rock was there on multiple occasions and therefore must have followed them around.
So everything is covered. In terms of their bodily needs, we'd say this would be kind of first article gifts in Lutheran parlance. Everything that this generation needs, they have provided to them free of cost from God. Is that kind of the picture of their 40 years in the wilderness?
Yes. They have all the basics they need. Now, obviously, they don't have everything they might want. But all the basics they need. No one is starving. No one is going without clothes. No one is going without shelter. The kind of the basic needs that the Israelites had were all taken care of.
When does the manna cease and why?
Well, they go into the promised land under the leadership of Joshua. And in Joshua 5, which is after the fall of Jericho, if I remember correctly, they celebrate the Passover. And then after they celebrate the Passover, we're told they ate the fruit of the land. So they ate the natural provisions of the land, the things that God had created to provide food for human beings. And at that point, we're told the manna stopped. God had now provided them the land of Israel, and in the land of Israel, they would have food that they could grow, trees that they could eat the fruit of, and so the manna ceased at that point.
Some of it is preserved in a jar and put into the Ark of the Covenant. Why?
As a reminder of Israel's rebellion against God, and more importantly, a reminder of God's providence for them, that he provided for them throughout their whole time in the wilderness. And so this was to remind them that God would continue to provide for them in the future. There were eventually three things that were put in the Ark of the Covenant: the tablets of the law that Moses made. You'll remember there are two sets of tablets. The first set of tablets was written by God, and Moses smashed them when he saw the golden calf. And so Moses was tasked for writing down everything God had sent at his covenant with Israel on two replacement tablets. Those were put in the ark. And then later on, the rod of Aaron that had budded to show that God chose Aaron and his sons to be priests, that would be put in the ark. And so there were three items then that would be placed in the Ark of the Covenant.
Let's move to the New Testament, where manna comes up in a conversation, as you referred to it before, in the account of Jesus feeding the multitudes. How does it enter the conversation?
Well, if we go to John chapter 6, Jesus is talking about him being the bread of life who comes down from heaven. And he gets a reply from those listening to him. Our ancestors ate manna in the wilderness. And then they quote the Old Testament. He gave them bread from heaven to eat. And then Jesus talks about, yeah, God did give them this manna from heaven, but he's giving them something that's not like their ancestors ate. They ate that, and yet they died. But those who eat the bread which comes down from heaven that he's talking about will live forever. And so, of course, Jesus is talking about himself when he talks about the bread of life. And he's, of course, talking about faith in him. And we receive the bread of life then through faith. And Jesus is saying that this is a better bread of life than what your ancestors had, because even though that was a gracious gift of God, it was not a gift of God that gave them eternal life. But Jesus is the gift of God that gives eternal life.
There's a little nuance in that conversation where the people contend that Moses, because they're asking for a sign from Jesus. This is after the feeding of the 5,000. And they say, what sign do you do that we may believe in you? Because Jesus has just told them the works of God are to believe in the one whom he has sent. They ask for a sign, and they say, Moses gave our fathers manna in the wilderness. But Jesus corrects them and says, it wasn't Moses, it was God. Why does he correct that point?
Well, I think because they have a tendency to think of Moses as the great miracle worker, and it was something special about Moses that allowed this to happen. And God is saying, no, Moses was my servant, certainly, but it wasn't Moses because he was so great or so faithful that caused this to happen. He was just the conduit through which God worked. It was really God who gave you manna from heaven, and you should be therefore grateful to God, and your first loyalty should be to him, not to Moses. Because as we know, especially the Pharisees were very loyal to what they interpreted to be the laws of Moses. But Jesus is correcting them and saying, no, your loyalty should be to God. And you should understand Moses, great prophet that he was, as the conduit through which God worked.
There's a parallel in that account of the giving of the manna with that very idea, if I recall, because three times in that account, the people are grumbling at Moses, but Moses says of himself and Aaron, well, who are we? What are we? Why are you grumbling against us? You're really grumbling against God himself. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, well, and see, I think it was easier for them to grumble against Moses, who they could see, rather than God, whom they couldn't see. And so they took it out on Moses, as it was. But Moses is reminding them that this is all God's doing. This isn't my doing. And in fact, if we go back to Moses' call, you remember he was very reluctant to go. And the point that God kept on making there is, Moses, it's not about you, it's about me. Well, the people have that problem too. They make it about Moses as a way perhaps of not having to directly confront God, but Moses is not letting them get away with it. You are confronting God, whether you want to admit it or not, because it's not me that can do this. It's only God that can do this.
So what should we know? This was given as both a lesson and a test, and obviously, first and foremost, given to them because they needed to eat, and God did dearly care for his people of the Old Testament. He's referred to as the shepherd that brought them through sheep through the wilderness. What should we here in the New Testament learn from the story of the real stuff, the manna in the wilderness?
We should learn that the first article stuff that we have is still very important, and that that too comes from God. But more importantly, that should point us towards the second article and the work of Jesus Christ, the true bread of heaven that comes down. And so this lesson is to remind us of the great works of God who provides for his people. And in some ways, all the provisions that are mentioned that God gives in all three articles of the Creed really are being pointed to here. It is all dependent on God, just as the Israelites were dependent every day on the work of God to give them manna. So we are dependent every day for our daily needs of body, but also our daily needs of forgiveness and life. And it's the work of the Holy Trinity constantly providing for us that is really being pointed to here in this provision of manna.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of the Concordia Commentaries on 1 and 2 Samuel, Proverbs, Daniel, and Ezra and Nehemiah. You can purchase these commentaries by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Steinman, thank you.
You're welcome.
On the other side of the break, we will be remembering 3rd century deacon and martyr Lawrence, remembered by the church on the 10th of August. Pastor Will Whedon will be our guest. We'll kick it off wondering, what was a deacon in the 3rd century? Stay tuned.
Let's examine the response of our Christian community to the cultural turmoil regarding sexuality and children.
Licensed clinical psychologist Dr. Beverly Yonke talking about her presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
In 50 years, we've spiked to what is now a cultural crisis from what was a nearly non-existent issue. We can wring our hands, remain unacquainted with the facts, or simply remain silent and avoid the unpleasantries. Biblical sexuality and God's created order aren't polling well these days, while media talking heads gush about the joys and justice of violating natural law.
You can meet and hear Dr. Beverly Yonke making the case for a Christian response to the transgender child at Issues Etc.'s Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas, Texas. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org.
You can teach lay people theology. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do you find yourself fixing the theology on store-bought greeting cards when you give them to friends and family? Put away that Sharpie. EdCruesome.com has greeting cards, art, jewelry, certificates, church banners, housewares, and all sorts of fantastic gifts that proclaim Christ crucified for us. Whether you're a value shopper or a collector, you'll find something at EdCruesome.com. That's A-D-C-R-U-C-E-M.com. bibletalk.com.
Some Bible passages make us more uncomfortable than others. Take, for example, any passage about money. But just because a topic makes us uncomfortable doesn't mean we shouldn't face it head on. That's exactly what the August issue of the Lutheran Witness has done, with articles on poverty, generosity, money management, and more. You won't want to miss it. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.